Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
President Obama took a break from his vacation today to say he thought Ben Bernanke should keep his job, praising the Republican Fed chair's bold and out-of-the-box thinking. Economists agree that the special lending programs that Bernanke created to pour money into the financial system are a radical departure for the Federal Bank, but critics say he gave too much to banks, and we're not out of the woods yet. Two reports today from the White House and the Congressional Budget Office pretty much say the federal deficit will explode in years to come. Bernanke is going to face a Senate hearing before being confirmed. So meanwhile, let's get a view of where we are in the economy. It's a decidedly liberal view from Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and columnist for The New York Times. He was a thorn in the side of the Bush administration and is proving to be quite a splinter for Obama as well. Newsweek magazine calls Krugman Obama's Nobel headache. So, Paul, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi there. Good to be on.
And now, you've criticized Ben Bernanke for missing the fact that there was a housing and credit bubble and for being slow to respond at the beginning of the financial crisis. But you've also written that he's earned the right to this reappointment. Why?
Because once it became clear that we had a really, really big crisis, Ben Bernanke responded aggressively, imaginatively. He understood the stakes. He may have been a little off on his forecast before it happened, but when it happened, he was as good a firefighter as we really could have hoped for. And so, you know, who would you have preferred to have in that seat this past year?
Well, tell us why. He, you know, cuts the prime lending rate, pours money into Wall Street.
It's cutting interest rates fast, realizing that we really were at risk of a second Great Depression. Unconventional policies, having the Federal Reserve out there buying commercial paper, which is, you know, private debt, having it buy long-term government debt. All of this is stuff that someone else might have hesitated, said, well, that's a little unusual. Let me wait until it's clear that we really are headed for another Great Depression. And Bernanke didn't do that, and I think we have to be thankful for that.
Well, and where do you think we are? Bernanke spoke last week with central bankers from around the world and said the prospects for a return to growth in the near term appeared good. He also warned that unemployment would remain high for another year. But was he right to be optimistic?
Well, I don't know if you call it optimistic. We're having a problem with language right now. That we basically have a binary language. We say either the economy is in recession, which is everything is going down, or the economy is in recovery, where everything is going up. We're either in hell or we're in heaven. Where we are right now looks like we're in purgatory. That is, the economy is probably growing if you measure it by GDP, but it's not generating jobs. The unemployment is probably going to be heading higher for quite a while. It's not the sum of all fears. 5 months ago, 6 months ago, it was actually reasonable to worry that we might be headed for 1930s conditions. That doesn't look like it's going to happen now, but it's a long, long way from what we really want to see.
Well, you know, you say purgatory. You've also said that the stimulus package wasn't bold enough. But what does someone like a Bernanke do? He's cut, as we said, the prime lending rate almost to zero, nowhere to go there, poured money into the financial markets. And you know, there's criticism that there's too much money floating out there and that he now has to navigate away from the shoals of inflation. So
That's kind of why I want someone like Bernanke, and it'll turn out to be Bernanke, in there, because he understands, I think, that these pressures are always there and that the great risk now is that he will, or that the Fed and the Obama administration will start to pull back too soon. This is what happened to the U.S. economy in 1937 when Franklin Roosevelt started listening to the voices of orthodoxy. It's what happened to the Japanese in 1997 when their government started listening to the forces of orthodoxy. And you start saying, oh, well, you know, maybe we should start worrying about inflation, when actually deflation is still the pressure that's on the economy. You start saying, well, you know, we're growing, even though we're very, very far below full employment, and you backslide. So, no, what he really needs to do is, basically, we need to keep all of these supports for the economy in place until we have a real recovery, which is not yet happening.
Well, this brings us to some of the spats you're having with people who are on the other side of the fence who say, no, 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 too much spending. I'm thinking of Harvard historian Neil Ferguson. You both wrote a panel discussion discussion at the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, you arguing for more spending, he saying that spending is going to lead to inflation and lead other countries to question whether the U.S. continues to be a good bet with such a debt. Now, I want to put aside how heated that debate got on blogs and everything. It's going to be a new Fox series, you know, when scholars fight at the Met.
I have had two blog posts on this over the course of 4 months. You know, this is not something that's major in my life.
But it's a big – that seems to be the crux of the matter, spend or keep an eye on the debt. And what about that question? Because a headline in the Times this week reads, America may need to find another financier. Floyd Norris writing that in 2006, China and Hong Kong bought half the public U.S. Treasury. So far in 2009, they've bought only 9%. This idea that the more the U.S. goes into debt, the less like a good deal we look to other countries that are supporting us, helping to support
us. Well, there are several things you need to bear in mind here. First, the reason China is buying so much less of our debt is that we are no longer running the big trade deficits we were running in the past. We actually don't need foreign financing to anything like the same extent. Who is buying our debt is Americans, because people are looking for a safe place to put their money. And there's actually a useful role, actually a critical role played by deficits right now. Because everybody's looking for a safe place to put their money. They don't want to spend it, so they're piling into U.S. government debt. If the U.S. doesn't supply that debt, the result is that there just isn't enough demand for real stuff in the economy, and the economy plunges. The reason we haven't had another Great Depression is in large part because, in fact, federal spending has continued, has been maintained at the expense of large deficits, which is not a good thing. But those deficits are, in a way, the flip side of supporting the economy through a very, very difficult time. So I don't worry at all about the revolt of the creditors. I do worry that if you look out 10 years, we will have a level of debt that is probably not crisis level, but is certainly not a good thing.
Well, and so what about that? I mean, take it off the table at the Met with economists and historians arguing, and you've debated others, including Harvard economist Greg Mankiw. What about all the people that we're seeing parading through town hall meetings? What about average Americans who are feeling frightened about just all the spending? They're not in favor of the stimulus.
Well, this is a problem because it is a little hard to explain what's going on here. I think the president hasn't done the greatest job of it. The stimulus is crucial in just putting a floor under the economy. Unfortunately, I don't think it was ever big enough to create a full recovery, but it has put a floor. If we had not had the stimulus, we would now be seeing the economy still falling as fast as it was in the first quarter of this year. We'd still be seeing the economy shrinking at a 5% annual rate. That's what pretty much all reasonable calculations suggest. And that would be, we'd be in a total panic right now. Now, the debt, we can run large deficits for several years. The U.S. is a wealthy country with a giant economy, huge tax base. What we can't do is we can't be a country that looks like it is incapable of ever taking the hard decisions needed to balance the budget once the economy has recovered. So it's not a question about what do the numbers look like this year. The question is, are we in fact a responsible nation able to pull ourselves together in the long run?
Well, and by the way, you note in one of your recent columns that when you press people who are complaining about the stimulus and saying that they're angry about it, what they're really angry about are the bailouts, which is different
from
the stimulus.
That's right. You say, well, why are you so against this? And they say, all this money going to bank executives. And that was a different program. It's actually a program that began under Bush. And it was almost certainly necessary to bail out some major financial institutions. Again, you don't one financial system collapse can ruin your whole day. But the way it's been done has been extremely friendly to the bankers. It has been basically rescue packages with no strings attached. It's bad economically. You could probably say, we're a big country. We can afford to waste $100 billion or two. But it's terrible politically. And I think that Obama really took a wrong turn. He squandered some very badly needed populist credibility on all of this stuff.
Well, you are hugely disappointed, it would seem, from your columns with Barack Obama. You say the astonishing thing about the current political scene is that nothing has changed. And you end a column by saying, how's it going to work out? Well, a crucial opportunity is being missed. We're at a turning point, and we're not making a turn.
Yeah. Now, look, the good things to say about Barack Obama is he's very smart. He's very calm. Those are things that served him very well in the final 2 months of the election campaign, when he was at least responding rationally to the financial crisis and McCain was not. But he has not been using his position to say to Americans, we really need to change from the course we've been on these past 30 years. His anti-Washington rhetoric tends to be a pox on both houses, whereas he really needs to turn us away from this right-wing, the market is always right, government is always bad ideology, and he has not done that because I think that's not what he believes, which is from my point of view, unfortunate.
Well, for instance, you say nationalize the banks and regulate them. You're writing it as others are. It was securitization that got us in the current mess, you know, this idea of buying and selling mortgages, and banks are back doing the same thing?
Well, yeah. Now, the bank regulation white paper that came out of the Obama administration was not bad, but there doesn't seem to be any force behind it. And the bank rescues have come with no strings attached. The call that some of us had for at least being prepared to temporarily nationalize or put into receivership some of the worst banks was partly a way to make sure that taxpayers were getting a good deal. If we're going to be providing the backstopping that makes these things survive, taxpayers should have a share in the upside as well. And that did not happen. Basically, the administration has been very, very worried about disturbing the confidence of financial institutions, which it's done a great job at restoring, but unfortunately that confidence hasn't led to lending, and in the process they've lost the confidence of the American people, which is rather more important.
Well, so what should he do? I mean, you quote your colleague Frank Rich, who says that there are people, especially on the left, who feel punked by Barack Obama,
yeah,
feel as if he's not who they thought he was and is siding too much, as you said, with Wall Street and the ideology maybe of the markets.
At this point, I think the window for taking a tougher line with the banks may have passed, although we can come back to it. But we need him out there now talking about health care with real passion, real fervor, and making the moral case. Not just I'm going to bend the curve and I'm going to reduce costs, because that has turned out to open the door to people saying, oh, you're going to have death panels and shuffle the seniors off to an early grave. This needs to be in the context of, this is the right thing to do. We can do this. It will be an outrage if we don't. A little bit of fire and brimstone about the opponents would be helpful. I don't know if he can do any of that. I don't know if that's him. But this is what we're missing. We're not seeing a compelling case for what can be done better. We've basically got the president portraying himself as a better manager, which undoubtedly he is compared with previous occupant of the office, but we're not seeing him really make that case for things need to be different in this country.
Let's stay where we were on health care, and specifically the proposed public option for the uninsured. I want to put aside for a second what you and others say are false claims about rationing care or pulling the plug on grandma. What about concerns about cost of public option? Make your case about cost.
The costs are modest in the scheme of things. All the proposals coming from various Democratic committees are deficit neutral. That is, they all pay for the expansion.
Paul, let me just stop you there. People don't believe that. And you do point out why public options, why you believe a public option will keep costs down. How?
Public option does two things. It provides effective competition for private insurers. In most states, there really is very little competition. There is one or two insurance companies that really dominate the market. They're pretty close to being monopolies, and the public option would give them some competition. And a lot of historical experience says that a straight, simple government plan, even if it's plain vanilla, will have lower costs.
Because you point out public plans usually have lower overhead and they have more bargaining power?
That's right. We have a pretty straightforward experiment. There are these plans, Medicare Advantage, where Medicare payments are funneled through private insurance companies. For much of the history of this, it turned out that Medicare was more efficient than any of these private plans. Maybe that wouldn't be true in a larger sense, but, you know, why not have that competition and see what happens?
But what about the fear that it would be true and it would put private insurance out of business?
Well, if they can't actually provide health insurance at lower cost, then why not have the government program?
You know, one of the most interesting things I've read of yours recently, you wrote about a town hall meeting in South Carolina. It was Representative Bob Inglis. And as we've been hearing in many town halls, people were standing up, and one man in particular was saying, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare."
This is the most amazing thing. People think that health care is basically paid for privately in America. And they don't realize many of the people demonstrating the town halls are, in fact, elderly people who are on Medicare. They don't realize that we actually have a largely government-run insurance system already.
Now, we don't want to be insulting of people who absolutely understand what Medicare is, but you give other examples of town halls.
Oh, this happens all the time. Arthur Laffer of the famous or infamous Curve was on TV saying, "You just watch what happens if the government gets its hands on Medicare or Medicaid. It'll be like the post office." Of course, Medicare and Medicaid being government programs, and the post office, by the way, being highly popular among the American people. So,
even though it's
sure,
not doing well.
Yeah, but that's because it has some mandates. Anyway, the point is there's been a tremendous amount of misinformation spread, and I don't think people are stupid. I think people are busy. They're harassed. They have lives. And if you have a constant flood of disinformation coming from the right, pretty much not fact-checked by many news media organizations, then people get a distorted impression. Can I say this is important because this actually relates to the issue of cost. When we ask the question, can we afford to have universal health insurance? The expensive people, the elderly, the very sick, are already covered by the taxpayer. They're covered by Medicare. They're covered by Medicaid. Private insurance companies only pay for about a third of health care in America right now. And the people who are uninsured tend to be young adults. They're actually cheap. It really costs remarkably little extra money to pay for the health care of the people who are now out in the cold.
But back to the huge fear, we were talking about the elderly and the Medicare recipients. And as you were saying, I mean, you give other examples of town hall meetings where people are screaming, keep the government out of my health care, and then they're asked to raise hands who's on Medicare, and the whole room raises their hands. There's this disconnect somehow of not understanding that government is already in their health care. But there's a fear that Medicare in particular is going to be cut to pay for this new plan.
It's certainly not in the plan. What's in the plan is simply that Medicare should do research into which treatments are effective and that this should be used to provide recommendations about what it pays for. The credible irony here is that the Republicans who are pushing this are the people who have been screaming for decades either that we must not have Medicare before it was implemented or that we must cut it. I mean, do people remember the government shutdown of 1995? The U.S. government shut down for a while and shut down in a confrontation between the Republican Congress and President Bill Clinton. And it happened because the Republicans were trying to force Clinton to agree to savage cuts in Medicare funding. Now those same people are saying, oh, the Democrats are going to take away your Medicare. They're going to send you to the death panels. It's incredible that this is happening right now.
Well, and that's the language that has very much frightened people. They think that an 85-year-old or an 80-year-old is going to be judged, you know, the treatment is going to be judged unnecessarily just because of your age.
It does not mean that at all. What researchers have looked at, what's very much influencing all of this, is that Medicare has vastly uneven spending across the United States. You can look at a place like Minneapolis and find that it spends much, much less on Medicare recipients than Miami does or actually New York does. What's happening is that in some places, basically the medical system has gone wild. Doctors ordering lots of unnecessary tests, doctors performing procedures that are as likely to do harm or more likely to do harm than good. Mm-hmm. So all that we're talking about here is trying to provide some guidance so that we don't waste money and actually probably degrade the quality of seniors' lives with unnecessary procedures.
And what about people on the other side of the fence who say, yes, we need improved health care, but pay for it with tax credits. Let the market do it. Don't completely revamp what we have, which some people feel is pretty good.
That's fine as long as you've never had a hangnail. Basically, the trouble with trying to do this through the individual market is that we know that it works terribly because insurance companies will reject you for insurance if you have any sort of pre-existing condition or anything they might interpret. So this notion that the market is the solution is a faith that flies totally in the face of evidence. This is a pure fantasy driven by ideology.
That's Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Paul, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.